Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast, made on Varick Street at WNYC.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today we're kicking off our annual Year in Music special. All this week, we're going to recap the best and worst of 2013. We'll talk about the hits that are built to last and a few that are not. And every day, we're going to listen back to some favorite live performances in our studio from the past year. So later in the show, we'll hear from Laura Mvula, Parquet Courts, and more. We've also got Soundcheck's musical gift guide for this holiday season, and in a moment, a top five from J. Edward Keyes of eMusic. But first, end-of-the-year lists are all the rage in December, so I've created one too. It's called... My Top 10 Reasons Why New York Music Ruled the World in 2013. All right, now it may seem odd to trumpet New York's musical clout in a year when New York's big names did not rise to the occasion. Both Jay-Z and Lady Gaga released albums, but neither turned out to be the juggernaut that fans were expecting. The best hip-hop seemed to come from Atlanta, although Run the Jewels is actually an Atlanta-Brooklyn collaboration. Anyway, Atlanta, Detroit, Southern California, and the best pop came from even further afield, with the New Zealand teenager Lorde leading an international pack. But New York music still ruled the world in 2013, and this week I'm going to give you 10 reasons why. Starting with number 10, Sun Lux. Sun Lux is the work of composer and singer Ryan Lott, and he is part of one of New York's most amazing music scenes, that group of young musicians who are classically trained, but who work just as easily in the world of pop and rock. Listen to the combination of orchestral writing and thumping rock energy in this song from his 2013 album, Lanterns. That's called Ransom from the 2013 album Lanterns by the New York artist Sun Lux. Reason number 9 coming up later in the show in my top 10 reasons why New York music ruled the world in 2013. But right now, let's turn to an expert. Joining us with his look back at the best of the year in music is J. Edward Keyes, editor-in-chief of eMusic. Joe, good to see you again.
Thanks. Good to be back.
So you've brought us some songs from your top five albums of the year. What kind of year was this for music?
It was a really interesting one, kind of on two fronts. I feel like as I was looking back over the course of the year, if I had to characterize it, I would probably use the word panic. I feel like as the market starts to collapse and genres start to shift, what's been fascinating is watching artists try anything and everything to get people's attention, a lot of times being very successful. Mm-hmm. So I think two of the things that we really saw over the course of the last year were genres becoming even more diffuse, right, and artists, established artists, seeming to be more willing to take more risks and try more things. And also from a purely sales perspective, people really going out on a limb and trying novel sales approaches. Everything as new as, say, dropping a surprise pop album at midnight and
as things Beyonce like that. Yeah, as Beyonce has done. So panic actually can produce some pretty good music, it sounds like.
I think so, too. I mean, if you look at one of the year's biggest selling releases, which is the Justin Timberlake record, for better or for worse, that is not a record that's crammed with pop singles. It's crammed with 7.5 minute lazy sounding R&B songs that stretch out forever.
But is that a result of panic on someone's part?
I think it's more a result of a realization that the old ways weren't working and being fine with that and accepting it and sort of stretching out and being willing to try new things and experiment a little bit more.
All right. So now you're talking about, you know, the genres blurring, the distinctions becoming even more indistinct as time goes by. And the album we're going to start with might be a pretty good example of that.
I think so, yeah.
Kanye West, Yeezus.
One of the things that I thought was so bold about this record, and to say out of the gate, this record has some problems as well. I mean, lyrically, there are some very problematic things, particularly as it relates to gender issues and sexual politics. Sonically, I think this record is incredibly brave. It's the first time an artist of Kanye's stature really is taking a large step forward and is trying to define the conversation and say, this is what pop music should sound like. It's really abrasive. You have lots of really harsh synths. It reminds me a lot of the industrial music that was coming out of Chicago in the late 80s. It very proudly has no cover art, no clear single. And it's really him throwing down the gauntlet and trying to make a record that's true to what it sounds like in his head, for better or for worse.
Well, let's hear the song Black Skinhead from Kanye West and the album Yeezus. That is Kanye West from the album Yeezus and a little bit of the song Black Skinhead, which is on J. Edward Key's list of the best new music of 2013. Joe is editor-in-chief at eMusic and joins us occasionally on Soundcheck. It's on your list. I've seen it on a number of other lists. And then there are other people who just – I mean, this is still a very divisive record, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It seems pretty polarizing. And as you say, for as many lists as I've seen it on, I've seen a lot of people feeling like it's a case of the Emperor's New Clothes. I personally don't. I really admire the audaciousness and how he stripped everything down and made it so minimal and was willing to be so abrasive and not worry about having a pop crossover hit.
And that dark and industrial sound certainly makes this stand out from a lot of his peers. Who else, though? Let's talk about The Knife.
Funnily enough, on eMusic's Best of the Year, The Knife is our number one record of the year, and Kanye is number two. And I feel like, in a way, they're sort of a similar piece. The Knife record also is, I think, sonically even braver than the Kanye record. Just as harsh, just as industrial sounding, where Kanye's record is really focused on racial politics in America. What I love about the Knife record is that it's really focused on economic politics and gender politics in America. I feel like you could put the two of them together and have a really interesting cultural study of 2013.
For folks who are trying to place the Knife, they are from
Sweden. They're a brother and sister team. They had a hit with a song called Heartbeats in 2003. And their initial sound was really – it was a darker shade of electropop, but it was still very listener-friendly.
Right.
This new record is proudly not very listener-friendly. It's – in the center of it, there's a 20-minute drone piece called Old Dreams Waiting to Be Realized. Most of the songs stretch on for 9 or 10 minutes, and it takes a lot of work to get into it. What's fascinating, as I started to read about this record, was they really wanted the record to be a manifestation of the kinds of political texts they were reading, both lyrically and sonically, too. They were trying to figure out ways, how do we apply feminist theory to songwriting? What does that sound like as a song? What does queer theory sound like as a song? And the fact that they went there, I think, is really brave and daring and really audacious.
The song Full of Fire comes from this album from The Knife. Their 2013 record is called Shaking the Habitual.
Questions and the answers can take faith.
Sweden, The Knife, and their album from this year called Shaking the Habitual. That song is called Full of Fire. There is plenty more where that came from, Joe, as you were mentioning. A lot of long songs on this record, long-form thoughts behind it. Speaking of long-form, you guys didn't just, at eMusic, you didn't just do a top 10 list. You did a big kind of look back at the year. In fact, it's called 2013, The Year in Music. Very nice title, the same as our week-long survey. How did you guys, what did you do? How'd you go about it?
Sure. Well, as we started to think about how we wanted to present our end-of-the-year package, you know, we always do a list. We always have a couple of interviews. And one of the things I've been getting really fascinated with is trying to figure out new ways to play with form on the internet and the way editorial is presented. So we ended up partnering with a company who could present this content in really interesting ways. So if you go to emusic.com/best of 2013, you're going to be presented with what look like decks of cards. You can click on each card. The cards will flip over. You can see our entire top 100 of the year. There's sound samples for each. There's links where you can buy them. Then some of the ancillary content, we also have 14 bands to watch in 2014. We have trend spotting, which are essays by really notable music critics on some of the trends that happened this year. And then we have essays with five artists that we thought made really significant artistic or commercial breakthroughs in the past year. So we're really trying to give an all-encompassing look back at the year. There's an app also for iPhone and iPad that you just eMusic Best of 2013. You'll find it, and it is free.
My guest is Joe Keyes from eMusic, editor-in-chief there at eMusic.com, and he's sharing his top five albums of the year with us on Soundcheck today. All right, we've heard Kanye and The Knife, who just happened to also be numbers 2 and 1, respectively, on the eMusic list. Let's go further down your list. Kacey Musgraves, getting a lot of love at the end of this year, it seems.
I have to say, Kacey Musgraves wrote hands down my favorite song of the year, Follow Your Arrow. What I love about Kacey, you know, I feel like a lot of the records that I noticed this as I was kind of putting together the list of songs that I wanted to talk about, the thing that defines them, and it's especially true of this Kacey Musgraves record, is there's a level of iconoclasm to all of them, questioning what can be done within the parameters of music. Kacey Musgraves, operating within contemporary country, which is traditionally a very conservative genre, very right-leaning, her album, Same Trailer, Different Park, is really bold in questioning a lot of what's been accepted in country music to this point.
So Follow Your Arrow is questioning what?
Follow Your Arrow is questioning a lot of things. It's questioning herd mentality. It's questioning conformity. And the boldest thing about it, as far as I can remember, it's the first country song that's openly endorsed gay relationships, gay marriage. And just, you know, one of the final lyrics in the song is say what you think, love who you love. It's a powerful song and is really moving the genre forward.
Let's hear it. Kacey Musgraves and Follow Your Arrow. Kacey Musgraves, taken on a lot of sacred cows in this album called Same Trailer, Different Park, and in this song called Follow Your Arrow. So was that, Joe, something you were looking for in your list of favorites, or did it just kind of materialize this sense of, as you said, iconoclasm?
Funnily enough, it happened accidentally. After I got the list together and looked at what some of my favorite albums and specifically songs were over the course of the year, I really noticed this characteristic jumping out,
yeah.
which got me thinking about sort of the year in general and how much that was true for a lot of the records that came out.
Up next, Sky Ferreira, a person whose career has, I mean, it is the definition of fits and starts, isn't it?
Absolutely. I love this record so much. Sky Ferreira's background is in modeling. She was a fashion model for a long time. So right away, it evokes this image of prettiness and perfection. A lot of the early demos she did, she worked with John Bryan for a little while. She's had a record deal since forever, and nothing's really ever materialized
right.
from it until this year. You got the sense that she was being groomed to go in a certain direction, and she very defiantly pushed against that, which resulted in this fantastic record which came out this year, which is the absolute definition of unpretty pop music.
Mm. And speaking of unpretty pop imagery, the album cover. I mean, you mentioned that she has a background in modeling. She's topless, but not in a way that's kind of a come-on. In fact, it's kind of a disturbing image almost.
It's really dark. I feel like it mirrors the theme of the records. I mean, the other thing that I feel like it really mirrors is the level of vulnerability at work on this record. When I saw her perform at Pitchfork Festival last year, I was blown away because she broke down crying in the middle of one of the songs, and it didn't seem affected. It didn't seem like a work. She was having a real moment on stage. That kind of fearlessness is throughout this record, and it really grabs at you.
So if people are thinking Fiona Apple or Cat Power, are those comparisons that could be made?
Sort of, but more sonically, far more abrasive.
No, but I mean in terms of that kind of emotional
vulnerability. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Let's hear Sky Ferreira and Heavy Metal Heart from her album from this year called Nighttime, My Time. Sky Ferreira from her album Nighttime, My Time, and the song Heavy Metal Heart. And Joe, I think people can hear what you were talking about, the idea of pop music that's not necessarily pretty. What did she do right this time that got this album finally released on what is a major label after all?
She ended up, after a series of failed sessions with a number of different producers, meeting up with someone named Ariel Rexhade, who's produced a number of great records this year. He did the Heim record. He did the Vampire Weekend record. The reason why he's a great choice for her is he's got pop credentials. He produced the Usher song Climax, but he's also got a lot of really strong indie records. He produced a Cass McCombs record. He produced the Glasser record. So he was the right sensibility, and there's a great piece about him on Grantland right now where he really wanted to draw out what he saw as her more punk rock side. And I feel like they really did that in the studio. A phrase I've been using a lot this year is it's like a lollipop stuck in a lint filter. Like there's a sweet center, but it's got all this fuzziness around it.
All right. Joe Keys has been sharing his top five albums of the year with us on Soundcheck today. We mentioned the eMusic website looking back at 2013, the best of the year in music. There is a section of that website called Hidden Gems, which is also the name of something we're doing later this week in our look back as well. Those things that you love, but you want to make sure that they're not completely missed out on it at all the end of the year hullabaloo. Give us your hidden gem for 2013.
Bedwetting Bad Boys. I love the Bedwetting Bad Boys so much.
Who are these people?
They're a band from Australia. One of the members of the band, Nick Warnock, runs a label in Australia called RIP Society. They are an excellent label, and I would strongly recommend everyone checking them out. They put out a band called Royal Headache last year that got a bit of attention as well. Mm-hmm. Everything on RIP Society is great. Well, this is his band. They're called Bedwet and Bad Boys.
Of course they are.
And it's like a drunker version of The Faces. It's really proudly messy and sloppy. Great kind of bar rock with like passing attention to detail, but if it gets there, it's not that big a deal. And that, I love stuff that's so sloppy like that, and this really delivers on that.
All right, this is Joe Key's hidden gem for this year. Joe, happy holidays, see you in the new year.
Likewise, thanks, John.
Take Soundcheck with you wherever you go with the all-new WNYC mobile app. Download it for free from wnyc.org/mobile.